Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
Los Angeles, I'm Zach Perchi. Welcome to AnCast. Normally, this is the segment where Justin and I banter back and forth about things we've seen and industry goings on, but we were having some serious audio issues, and we wound up doing something like three takes on the same conversation, and the final result was still screwed up. It's a really bizarre problem, and I would normally just run it, but the audio problems are kind of insurmountable. Here's a sample.
Seven Jesus figures who just get beaten up by society and must, you know, with the power of friendship and their own manliness, they will persevere.
So, there you go. Assuming you don't want to listen to Justin and his disembodied, staticky, fucked up voice, we're not going to use that. So, a brief summary of what we talked about. The summer season sucks. The leaks from the TV Tokyo leaks are weird, and nobody really knows what happened there yet. It's all speculation, and there's really nothing obvious about who leaked those episodes. That's pretty much what we went over in a nutshell. The interview we have is pretty awesome, and it's about an hour, so we're just going to go ahead and get straight to that, and we'll have a normal show for you next week. All right, take it easy, dudes.
Okay, sir, you're free to go.
Good, because I got a hot date tonight. Odd date. Dinner with Fred. Dinner alone. Watching TV alone. All right. I'm going to sit at home and ogle the ladies in the Victoria's Secret catalog. Sears catalog. Now, would you unhook this already, please? I don't deserve this kind of shabby treatment.
So we're back, and joining us this week is artist and animator Tim Eldred. Welcome, Tim.
Howdy, folks.
Thank you for inviting us into your nerd lair, your incredibly impressive nerd lair.
Yeah, we basically walked into his back office here at his home in Burbank, and holy cow, it's just this, it's what I wished my apartment looked like if I had room.
Well, the first time I ever walked into a Mandarake store, I said, this is what I have to recreate at home. And I think I'm about halfway there.
I would say so, yes.
I just need big glass cases with toys in them now.
So, I mean, our listeners are primarily anime fans, and they may not be familiar with your history. So, you know, tell us about yourself.
Well, I first got the anime bug back in 1980, right after I saw Star Blazers. Mm. Prior to that, I'd seen Speed Racer and watched it every day, but wasn't really aware of it as anime. So, jump forward a few years from that, Star Blazers comes on TV, and it actually says in the end credits, originally created in Japan as Space Cruiser Yamato. And so that was the first time I can remember watching an anime and realizing exactly what it was and getting completely hooked and transfixed and mesmerized. And now here I am, living in my own personal Mandarake. And watching Star Blazers helped to kind of focus me on what I wanted to do with my life, which was to get into some sort of creative field that would allow me to participate in the making of something that good. Hmm. And I was living in the Midwest at the time, so the only option that was really open to me personally was to do comics. Hmm. So I started doing comic books just for myself. And after several years, got a professional career doing that. And that helped to boost me into the animation business when I moved from Michigan out to California. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that the comic book field had perfectly prepared me to go into TV animation because I could draw storyboards and earn a lot more money and work for bigger and more visible projects. So that was sort of the skein of my day job. And in the meantime, I was constantly pursuing fanish projects of my own, too. I think the first big one was a guide to the series Armored Trooper Votums, which was the next big thing that really grabbed me after Star Blazers. That brought me into contact with companies like Central Park Media and other fan groups who were doing similar things. I actually took over a CFO group in Michigan, turned them into a club called Animania, which is still in existence today, and I guess has grown into a giant in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So,
yeah, anybody, I remember seeing posters for that in high school.
Yeah, anybody who happens to be listening from Animania, hello. Thank you for carrying the torch. The next big thing for me was to get into professional OEL comics, mainly through CPM and through Voyager Entertainment. We can go into that later if you want to. Where I finally did get to draw Star Blazers comics and Armored Trooper Votum's comics, and other things kind of spiraled outward from there. These days, my day job is to draw storyboards for animation programs like Batman, The Brave and the Bold, and The Spectacular Spider-Man, and another project called The Avengers, which is based on the Marvel property, which is being done right now at Starz Entertainment, and doesn't have a network commitment yet, but when Marvel movies begin to explode, you'll definitely see it somewhere. So there's a lot of anime in my history, a lot of superheroes and other things. But the pet project that is still ongoing for me is starblazers.com, which is the website for Voyager Entertainment, and it allows me to now do as much research as I want into the whole history of Space Battleship Yamato and the making of the original anime and all the new stuff that's happening these days. It's still alive and well.
So what was your first exposure to the pro side of things? Like, when did you really first cross that bridge from being, you know, drawing comics on your own to really doing things for money?
That came from going to comic book conventions, and specifically the one that used to be in Chicago. I don't know if it still is, but it was called Chicago Comic Con. And that was the best opportunity someone like me living in the Midwest had to brush up against the pros. And year after year, I would go to that convention, and I would take my work with me, just the projects I'd done for my own personal enjoyment, with the hope of finally getting a professional assignment. And it took about 10 years from start to finish. And the finish line was actually meeting an editor from Malibu Comics who had just gotten the rights to Lensman. Lensman had come out in 1984 in Japan as an animated feature film and then as a TV series. Malibu had previously gotten Robotech and Captain Harlock, and Lensman was sort of the third jewel in that anime crown that they were building. And so I came along at exactly the right time with exactly the right kind of portfolio, and I got hired to draw it. So within a couple of months, I was a comic book professional. That would have been summer of 1989, and it just grew from there. Over subsequent years, Malibu liked me enough to pay for my move across country to put me where I am now. And after Lensman finished, I was able to then work on Captain Harlock and also Robotech. And that led into other projects for CPM and Voyager, which is actually kind of a funny little side note, but it's the side notes in life that spiral you into the next big thing. While I was at Malibu, they were approached by the president of Voyager Entertainment. He came to them and said, "We own this very well-known property called Star Blazers. Would you be interested in licensing it for a comic book?" And as soon as I found out that was on the grounds, I was like, "Wait a minute, Star Blazers is here with me in the same building."
Froth.
And as I kind of sat on the sidelines and watched this process, the editors at Malibu looked it over and said, "Nah, I don't think so. We want to do superheroes instead." And, you know, jump forward, where is Malibu now?
I don't think it was because they turned down Star Blazers.
Well, when you invest heavily in superheroes, you take your life into your own hands. And many companies learned that. Anyway, I was in the right place at the right time once again, because I had now a direct line to the owner of Star Blazers, and I got together with a couple of buddies, and we put together our own little studio, and we approached them and said, "Malibu is not interested in licensing it from you, but we can be your studio, and we can do the comic book for you." and they thought that sounded like a great idea, so they hired us. And almost immediately on the heels of that, we made the same pitch to John O'Donnell at Central Park Media, and that was the foundation for CPM Comics.
I always wondered what was going on, how that came about.
Right. John had also already been in touch with Malibu about Project Aiko. I guess that was one of his big favorites. And so he decided, I want to do an Aiko comic. And he got involved with Ben Dunn to make that happen. And I guess Ben was drawing it originally for Malibu, or maybe it was an Antarctic project that became a Malibu project. I'm not quite clear on those origins. But by his second issue, he was having trouble keeping up with the workload. So I stepped in to help him out and then finished it for him. And that coincided with the founding of CPM Comics. So when Series 1 of Aiko was done, CPM just took over and we did Series 2 and then Aiko the Versus.
I see. Yeah. And then you eventually got everyone's favorite, M.D. Geist.
M.D. Geist, which
I spent a good 3 weeks trying to edit to the director's cut, which no longer matched at all. Did you know that your comic was actually used to recreate it into the director's cut?
No, I was unaware of that.
Yeah, because the original just made no sense at all. So anyway, a little anecdote there. All right, so long story short, you end up getting into the actual animation side of things. Could you describe a little bit the differences and how they're similar between doing regular sequential comics and storyboards?
Well, the biggest difference is that you've got to draw a lot more pictures for storyboarding. They don't have to be quite as detailed because what you're creating is not a finished product. It's an instruction manual on how to create the finished project. So in my case, as a storyboard artist, I'm supplied with a script and a collection of model sheets, so I know what everybody's supposed to look like. And then I, through whatever magic happens in my brain, which even I don't understand, I visualize what's in the script as a scene on a screen, a TV screen, occasionally a movie screen, but usually TV. And then I draw it out using however many individual frames that requires. In comics, you can compress a lot of action into one picture. And as long as you pick the right sequence of pictures, you can actually do a lot with a little bit of space. But with TV storyboards, your picture is always going to be the same size, and it could represent any increment of time. It could be a quarter second, a half second, a full second. It could be 30 seconds if somebody's just sitting in one place, not moving and talking. So you have to adapt yourself differently to the process of converting words into pictures and managing the manipulation of time in a film sense as opposed to a literary sense. Short story, or the short version of that is you end up drawing a lot more.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. So I noticed a lot of your the shows that you tend to be the more obsessed about are the ones that are these big, long, intricate, sprawling wars.
Right.
From Yamato to UC Gundam to Votoms. I think the book you wrote on Votoms actually recreated on the DVDs, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah. Well, the CPM version. There have been others.
Right. So what draws you to this sort of material?
I think the biggest draw for me is just simply the time that I got into anime, which was 1980. Whenever you get in, it's my theory that whatever you see within your first year decides what you like, because you're drawn into a certain style, a certain cadence, a certain genre, and that sort of colors your view. That becomes your standard.
So like Zach with Tenchi.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the opposite of that. The stuff I was exposed to at first, I would hit myself for enjoying now.
The exception of the rule. But it still showed you what you didn't like, which is just as instructive as showing you something you do like, right?
Well, at the time, I loved it.
Okay.
Now, if I look back, I'm like, man, I was into that. Like, my tastes changed.
But that was in the 90s, right?
Yeah, that was in the 90s. And
that was in the 90s, and to be fair, you know, teenagers will watch almost anything.
Yeah, it's a little different, I think. And you're also talking about a pretty big leap in terms of storytelling quality. Yeah. So, I mean, what you're talking about is Yamato, which is a revered classic of the ages, and I wouldn't say that for, let's say, Slayers. You know.
So in a way, you were kind of a victim of the 90s, because yeah, almost all the stuff being done then was by the Nisei of anime, the second generation of creators, as opposed to the first generation.
Right.
Which I think filled the 70s and petered out maybe halfway into the 80s. And then the second generation of creators picked up from there. And I think the big difference is that generation grew up watching anime, whereas the previous generation didn't have that opportunity.
Right, they were pioneers.
Right. So their influences came from a lot of different sources. And it was also colored by their own life experience, which was growing up in Showa-era post-war Japan, and all of the cultural and the psychological trappings of that. So to get back to your original question, what draws me to those kinds of stories is the fact that they're written by people who, to put it one unique way, had their bubble burst, had their immortality bubble burst. What do I mean by immortality bubble? It's that bubble that we all grow up with as children, thinking that nothing can hurt us, we are special, we are immortal. And it's not until you become an adult, when you have to break out of that bubble and enter the adult world, where you're not quite so special and you're not immortal and you are a subject to the slings and arrows. And I think in Japan, that bubble was broken on the cultural level by the loss of World War II. And so the people who had to grow up in the post-war atmosphere without that immortality bubble around them had the same experience, or at least a similar experience, to the soldiers who actually fought in the war, which broke their bubble instantly. I mean, I've been reabsorbing a lot of World War II literature and stuff since The Pacific came onto HBO a couple of months ago. I absorbed the series and the book for that. That inspired me to go back to Band of Brothers also and reabsorb that and just be overwhelmed by how amazing it was. And what I came out of it with this time, this viewing, was that to be in a war makes you realize that everything reduces down to the barest of concepts when your life is physically threatened. And when you come out of that, you're going to have a very different view of the world than if you don't participate in it. I mean, we now have never... I assume that you guys have never been in a war. I've never been in a war. I've never had my life threatened.
Do we look like soldiers?
My immortality bubble is still there, and so are yours, I think. But when you go through the experience of having that bubble broken, at least either on a personal level or a cultural level, it's going to inform your creative decisions, and it's going to create a very different view of the world than if you don't go through that. And I think, I know I'm kind of going on and on about this, but I think the biggest difference in culture between Japan and America is that a lot of our media still has that immortality bubble around it. You know, we have heroes like Superman who are invulnerable. We have heroes like the Lone Ranger or the Shadow who were dealt blows to their psyche, but then bounced back and became better than they were before. They became superheroes. And I reach back to those because they were all formed in the 30s during the Great Depression, when the entire country was being dealt a mortal blow on a daily basis. And so the way they responded, at least in the media, was to create superheroes that had some special, unique, immortal characteristic that allowed them to bounce back and become better. In Japan, the 1950s were all about rebuilding society from zero. And so the kids who were growing up in the 50s had that experience to bring to the anime they wrote in the 60s and the 70s.
Hence the transforming fighters that would combine, therefore, the teamwork.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just one example of many. So when it came to the 80s, the time I got into anime, we were getting Mobile Suit Gundam, Armored Trooper Votoms, you know, all the other shows by the creators of those, Tamino and Takahashi. We had Macross, we had Yamato, which was just winding down in 1983. And those were stories written by people who had actually experienced war or had experienced the aftermath of war. And so...
grew up hearing a lot of war stories from
people. Yeah, they were surrounded by it.
Yeah.
And so the viewpoint they brought to those stories was far more realistic than the pseudo-war stories we got on American TV during the 80s.
Well, specifically, from that perspective, it's completely unique in that I don't think there's a comparable country that has produced so many films and book, comics and just media in general from the perspective of a country that has lost a war.
Right.
It's completely unique. And it's kind of fascinating that so much war material comes out of Japan. You know, Gundam is basically a long war story. Mm-hmm. And this is from a country that lost. We were just in Japan in April. And it was fascinating to me because I went to this museum that was this weird tucked away little museum that was about the survivors coming back from Russia after World War II and the hardships they went through. Mm-hmm. And it was literally a museum from the perspective of a country that, in spectacular fashion, lost a war, which you will never see in America. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's interesting that I think that sensibility is what you're talking about. It just informs all that stuff from the 80s really heavily.
Yeah, yeah. And that gives you more realistic heroes that are easier to identify with. Pick any action cartoon from the 80s that was made for American TV, and you get a completely different stereotype. The one that jumps to the front of my brain at the moment is G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
A real American hero.
The Texas version of the soldier, you know, the stereotype of the American soldier.
Yeah, and of those two examples, the Japanese and the American one from the 80s, which one is more relevant today? Which one can you go back to over and over and get something out of every time you watch it?
Depends. Are you after annoyance?
Yeah, that's interesting.
About some of the other stuff that you've been into, the Leiji Matsumoto stuff in particular, do you find anything about it that you, like, obviously you've absorbed so much anime. How has this influenced your own stuff?
My own stuff. Well, anybody who wants to see what I do with those influences can go to my website, greasemonkeybook.com. It's devoted to my graphic novel, which is called Grease Monkey. And it's a little more lighter fare. It's a sci-fi comedy. And it's a little bit like if you were to combine Planet of the Apes with Battlestar Galactica and make it funny. That's the most basic description I can give of it. But it is still also a war story. It's about the aftermath of a war and what Earth is doing to put itself back together and then go out and find the aliens who just about wiped out the human species. The concept that makes it funny and gives it a monkey reference is that other aliens come to Earth after the big attack and they help humans to recover, and they also accelerate the intelligence of gorillas and make them into human-compatible creatures. And so we have humans and gorillas together on a spaceship, and that's where the Planet of the Apes Battlestar Galactica reference gets put in. Anyway, I took a lot of influence from Yamato for that. I take a lot of influence from Leiji Matsumoto in that he is, I think, one of the best writers for capturing the everyday human experience and combining it with a fantastic scenario. For example, with Yamato, he took a lot of his own personal family history and built it into the characters, specifically his father. His father was a World War II pilot. He was the head of a squadron. And what Matsumoto remembers most about his father now, at least according to some of the research I've done, is that in his post-war years, all he ever did was apologize for what happened during the war. Many, many times, his father would be approached by the widow of one of the pilots under his command. And the widow would demand to know, why is my husband not still alive? What did you do? Why couldn't you prevent his death? And the only answer his father ever had for that was, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And that became the basis for the character of Captain Okita, or Captain Avatar, in Yamato. In the first episode, he's confronted by Kodai, or Wildstar, and Kodai says, why couldn't you save my brother, who had just died earlier in the episode? And the only answer was, I'm sorry. And so, obviously, I don't have the Matsumoto life experience, but I can at least see how he can take a real-world person and build it into an anime character and have it resonate and be relevant. And so that's, I think, the standard that I've always tried to reach for as well.
How much? I mean, when you did the Star Blazers comics and the, mm-hmm. How much creative freedom did you have?
Well, at the time we were adapting.
Yeah.
When we started out, and we had pretty much total run to do anything we wanted because from the very beginning we revealed that we were completely dedicated to the show. Mm-hmm. And only wanted to do it justice. And so I think going into it with that attitude earned us all of the freedom that we needed to do a good product. And that still carries on today. I'm still doing Star Blazers comics for the website. Mm-hmm. And I still have a completely free hand to do what I want to with them because I'm trusted by the owner of the property. If anything, maybe I'm a little too loyal because I'm always trying to return it to the original Yamato concepts instead of hewing to the Star Blazers concepts, which are great, but they're one step removed. And some of them are a little goofy.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
You know, most anime fans these days are younger, and they're obviously not really seeing a whole... most of them, you know, obviously there's a few that were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, but most of them don't have anything to do with war as it currently is. They're like us. We're pretty far removed from it.
Right. I have occasionally heard from anime fans who are there. Once or twice I've gotten a letter through Voyager thanking me for all the work I do on starblazers.com from troops in Iraq who I guess are stuck with nothing better to do than surf the internet. But it's very gratifying to know that A, there are still Star Blazers fans out there, and B, that I'm giving a soldier in a war, a real war, something other to think about besides, you know, whatever risks he has to face day to day.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
At CPM, we used to get letters from prisons.
Ah.
About the hentai.
Okay.
Anyway, but you know, a lot of younger fans, they, you know, they see this giant wall of Yamato and giant wall of Gundam, giant wall of you know, all these long shows. Votoms is, you know, goes on for what, 70 some episodes.
Well, the original show is 52, but there've been additional OAVs and things since then.
Right. For the uninitiated, where would you recommend for a good place to start to just get your feet wet with this sort of material?
Good question. They are kind of intimidating because, number one, they're older, and so they don't look as pretty as stuff you can see today. And maybe they take a little more effort to find because they're not constantly in print, or they're not as... fingertip ready as some of today's anime is. But just going one by one, if you wanted to explore Gundam, I think you really need to start with the first series. As rough as it is on the eyes, it sets the tone for everything that comes afterward. And they do make it a little more digestible by giving you the movies. You know, the movie version is a slightly better, more focused version of the TV story, which can wander a little bit.
So this isn't a case where the cut-down movies are just, like, completely watered down and terrible?
No, the opposite of that.
Really?
Yeah. The Gundam movies, the original three, were based on the TV series. They mostly reused animation from the series, but they included some new stuff, and they helped to focus the story better because you didn't have quite as many throwaway episodes, and the line from start to finish was more of a straight line instead of a meandering line. Tomino is probably the worst offender when it comes to that. That's what makes so many of his shows inaccessible. I mean, not only do they have huge episode counts, but they also wander off the path quite a lot. I'm having a lot of trouble right now with one of his series called Overman King Gainer.
I've heard that one's a slog.
It is. It's only half the length of a usual Tomino show. It's only 25 episodes, but I'm up to episode 10, and I still have yet to figure out what the story is.
God.
It's almost as if you were to just take a 50-episode Tomino series and then remove random shows and then watch what's left in order, thinking that you're missing out on something. And best not even continue there. But anyway, back to the point. Gundam, the best way to start that is to watch the movies. You can get the TV series because it's all been dubbed. And I think those are still available.
No.
No?
No, those are really hard to find now.
Okay.
And they were dub only as well.
Yeah, that's true. And it was for Cartoon Network, and it was 50-50. It was okay. By the way, slight side story there. When I found out Cartoon Network was going to show the original Gundam, I got all set up to record it from day one, which was the summer of 2001. And as they were getting close to the end, they suddenly stopped it for no apparent reason, except that it was on 9/11.
Oh, yeah, no reason at all.
Yeah. 9/11, of course, was a Tuesday. The day before, they'd run their regular episode. On that day, they stopped running Gundam. And it never, ever appeared on Cartoon Network again, as far as I could tell.
They started showing it at like 4 o'clock in the morning in bursts when they were trying to fill space, I think.
Okay.
That first Gundam was forced on Cartoon Network. They had to show that. That was a demand. If they were going to do any Gundam, they had to do that one. They'd start from there. But, yeah.
So 9/11 gave them a perfect excuse to get out from under it, huh?
Maybe.
You know, given how it looked, and, you know, that dub wasn't terrible, but it wasn't spectacular. Right. I'm sure that didn't get very good ratings.
Yeah.
No.
I think the trouble that Gundam has always had in America is that the first series, the one you really need to see to understand the others, has never existed in a marketable form here. And so their tendency has always been to skip over it and go to Gundam Wing or Gundam Seed or one of the other, you know, multiple
recent shiny Gundams.
Yeah, spin-offs, which are okay in and of themselves, but if you really want to see what that story is about thematically at its core, you need to start with the first one, go on to Zeta Gundam, maybe try to find Double Zeta Gundam if you can. I mean, I love it, but apparently Bandai is never going to release it, so you're stuck with the internet for that. And then there's the concluding movie in that whole stretch, which is Shaw's Counterattack. And if you can get through all those, you'll have a firm rooting in Gundam, and you'll know what it's about.
That's a long education process.
It is, yeah. It is. And I speak
It's a lot to ask of people.
Well, I speak with the luxury of hindsight, looking back over, you know, God, almost 30 years of anime collecting. So I was able to take my time with it. Obviously, the people that go to it are going to be self-selected, and will hopefully have the patience to get through it. So anyway, that covers Gundam. With Yamato, the first Yamato movie is the easiest one to get into. It is also a condensation of the first TV series. You're going to miss a lot of subtlety, but at least you'll be able to see it all in 2 hours.
How is the dub of... Is that only available dubbed, or...?
No, that's never been dubbed.
Oh.
Star Blazers was dubbed, of course.
Right.
All three Star Blazers TV series were done. But only one Yamato movie was ever done. That was the second one, called Farewell to Yamato. And that was, I don't think it was an officially a Streamline project, but it's got Streamline's fingerprints on it, just in terms of voice actors and the way they adapted the script. And it was done in the late 80s for Linguaphone, which was a Japanese company that would put a dubbed movie out on a VHS tape with a translation guide, and it was used as an English-Japanese language lesson, an instructional tool. That company did Farewell to Yamato. They did one of the Lupin films, I think, Cagliostro Castle. They also did Sherlock Hound and one or two other things. And I'm sure they had a co-production going with Streamline because of the voice cast and the overall directing style. So the first Yamato movie is only available subtitled, but if you're going to get into Yamato, you just have to go with subtitles. again, I think it's a self-selected crowd.
Right.
If you have the
ability... If you're interested in getting into Yamato, you're probably not going to mind subtitles.
Yeah, exactly. And if you decide you like it enough to explore Star Blazers, those are all dumped for you. And you can order any of the DVDs at starblazers.com. The third show in that list was Votums.
Votums, you're pretty much screwed.
Yeah. personally, I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's an awesome show. It does have kind of a safety valve built into it in that if you start watching it, the first story arc ends at show 13. So if you just commit to the first 13 episodes, that's not a huge time commitment. And I personally think by the end of that, you're going to be hooked and ready to continue. And the good news there is that they're still making Votum stuff today that looks as good as anything else that's out today. So ultimately, that's waiting at the end of the path.
With these shows now, I've never been super huge into the sprawling, you know, mecha war epics. but I found that the real barrier of entry is just sitting down to watch it. Justin and I sort of took on the challenge late last year of Legend of the Galactic Heroes, which we've heard about for years and years and years and years.
Plan on finishing it at some point.
And we kept hearing, you know, this is the greatest thing ever. You guys got to watch it. I'm like, this isn't the kind of thing that I normally really get into. I don't have a problem with it. But so I sat down and watched the first one. And I was like, man, this is kind of a slog. And I was like, oh, I'll try the second one. The second episode dragged me in. I was like, wow, this is really interesting. Huh. Like, suddenly this has characters, and it's very sophisticated storytelling. Uh-huh. And what I decided was, okay, I know my instinct as an anime fan is to marathon this show, but I think I'm going to kill myself if I do that. So I'm only going to watch one a week, and I've been doing that
since.
That's
over 100 episodes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yes, he's going to be doing this for the next 4 years.
Yeah, I'm only like 30 episodes into it. I'm enjoying it, but I'm glad I only do it
one. Oh, you're still going?
I'm still doing it, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I have to watch one a week, one every Sunday. That's it. Now, do you think that tactic would work for some of these, like Votums or the original Gundam or the Yamato, where there is sort of a barrier of entry, but I think people just naturally marathon things when they have a chunk of it in front of them?
Well, it's also a testament to how entertaining the show is, because if you only want to see it in short bursts, like it sounds like you're satisfied with only seeing that once a week.
Yeah.
Other shows will probably inspire you to keep watching because, at least in the case of Votums, almost every episode ends on a cliffhanger, and they're really well constructed. So you get to the end of one and think, I'd like to see what happens next, right now.
Right.
Yeah, I think the first season of Votums I end up marathoning.
Yeah.
Not all at once, but, you know, like two or three sessions. I really like the first season, and the second season kind of lost me. It got demoted to my I'll get to this pile.
Ah, okay. Well, another thing that Votums does...
Which is, by the way, about the size of this room.
Another thing that Votums does really well is the world building. It doesn't give you too much all at once.
Right.
Which I think is a function of it being a Ryosuke Takahashi show. He's much better than, say, Tomino at giving you just what you need at any given time, and not too much.
Now, these days, Takahashi, he's working... Well, I think most fans of our generation know more for Gasaraki.
Gasaraki, and then Gal Gaigar. He also wrote that, or at least produced it.
Yeah, and the show that Media Blasters gave up on.
Yeah. Those two, I think, are exceptions to the rule. I think he lost a little bit of his step with Gasaraki because that was made in the 90s, and most of the other anime that was being done then was by fans of anime or manga or video games. But Takahashi, at least then, was a fan of the daily news. That's what he absorbed. He was like ravenous for news, world news, international news, political news, anything he could read. And so he was intent on turning that into an anime story, and that's why we got so much political baggage with it. And I think that's what makes it a little harder to relate to as entertainment.
Gasaraki, the storytelling, frankly, I thought it was a mess. I mean, I had a hard time even getting through the first couple. I mean, it's just, I don't know that that instinct helped him, because it got to a point where he wasn't telling a coherent story. It was a mess.
Right.
And that show turned out to be kind of a failure for
It was ADV. So hyped.
Yeah, it was. It was really hyped, but ADV kind of failed with that one.
Yeah, I think even in Japan it didn't do that well. It had some technological things about it that were interesting.
Had a really cool opening.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I remember about it mostly, and being confused.
Right.
But, yeah, I think the story was just a little too dense for what he had in mind. But go back to the Takahashi of the 80s, when he had this string of amazing shows like Dugrum, which led to Votums, which led to Gallant, which led to SPT Lesnar. Those still hold up great today. And if you can get them and start watching them from episode one, you'll see that world building, and you'll see how one concept just sort of naturally, organically builds on what came before. And I think that's the key to really keeping somebody interested, because when I compare that to King Gainer, in which everything is thrown at you in the first episode and you're lucky to make it out alive, that to me goes against my storytelling instincts. I just consider that to be sloppy.
Well, most of these guys are pretty old now. I mean, they've got to all at least be pushing 60. Most of them are older. I think Tomino, he looks old.
That's a rough 70.
Yeah, really.
Who knows what he's ingested.
Yeah. Right.
So, at any rate, last I checked, I don't see any of these big three guys, Takahashi, or Tomino, or even Matsumoto, really doing all that much these days.
Well, no. As you get close to retirement age, you don't really want to. Takahashi fought for years and years against doing any more Votums because he was tired of it being his number one best-known show. I don't know what finally turned him around, but he did it in 2007, started making new Votum stuff again. And I'm glad he did. I don't necessarily like all of it as much as I do the original show, but it's nice to see that he's working and he's still having an influence on this generation of animators. Tomino just continues to be chained to the Gundam Beast.
He always seemed like he completely resented it.
Yeah.
To me, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came to the U.S. it was 2 years ago, I think, and did a round of conventions, and everybody got their Tomino interview, and it was just, he's the crankiest. He can match, I think, Hayao Miyazaki for a cranky old man shaking his cane at the kids.
I wonder if he hates the iPad too. That reminds me of something interesting about Tomino and his outlook. And again, a little side note: did you ever see Space Jam?
Yes.
The Warner Brothers movie?
I knew better.
Do you remember the scene where Daffy Duck bends over and kisses his own ass, and it's got the Warner Brothers logo on it?
Okay, well, I tried my hardest to forget Space Jam, so
okay.
No.
Well, that's the only thing I remember from Space Jam, so it stands out. And it relates to this next thing, which is Tomino. In Gundam Seed Destiny, which I don't know if you guys have seen.
Pardon, this is bits.
There's something like that. It's almost like a cry for help, or at least an internal commentary on what everybody's been reduced to. As you know, Gundam is driven by Bandai's toys and models.
Right.
That is its reason for existing. And if something great is done with the anime as a secondary function, so be it. But in Gundam Seed Destiny, there's a scene where we're sitting around the table with the bad guy who's laying out for his acolytes why we fight this war. And he points off to this giant mobile suit walking by. And he says, that's why we fight this war, because of these robots and the money they make for the industries who create them. And watching that scene, I thought, oh, Tomino, you brilliant son of a bitch.
Well, did he even work on Seed?
Seed Destiny? His name is all over it, so I assume he had something to do with it. And who better than him could make a comment like that in such a sneaky way?
Yeah, seriously.
So I got to ask, sort of a side note, how do you feel about the live action, what you've seen of the live action Yamato?
Live action Yamato, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I am really excited. Every time I see something new on it, I want to see it more.
You think it looks like they did it justice?
Well, they're doing what, at least they appear to be doing what I would like them to do, which is to go back to the original Seed, the original spirit, and do something original with it again. I don't want them to just remake the anime, because I can see the anime anytime I want. And I think remaking something and trying to be loyal to it just dooms you to comparison for the rest of your life. For example, the Watchmen movie. Mm. I think that movie is great. I liked it a lot. But it's so close to the comic that when I'm watching it, I'm distracted by thinking about the comic. And then it becomes more like a checklist than a film.
Yeah, I remember I saw it in the theater. I went to the midnight because I was all hyped up because I've been a Watchmen fan since the 90s. And Bubesta shows up at the end of the film, completely unexplained.
Right.
I'm like, there's just this weird cat. For anyone who doesn't know who that is, like, suddenly there's this weird beast in the room. Like, the rest of the audience has question marks over their head. The comic book fans are like, oh, they managed to get him in there. Like, but it's completely unrelatable for the rest of the audience.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it really limited the audience for that. Yeah.
Right. When I go to Japan on December 1st and sit down to watch the Yamato movie, which I will, the last thing I want to do is sit there for 2.5 hours with a checklist in my hand thinking, okay, they got that right. They got that right. Ooh, not that part. I just want to be entertained by this story that I know really well, but then see something new done with it.
Yeah.
So that I can feel like I'm seeing it again for the first time.
Yeah.
And if they do that, I'll be very happy.
Yeah, that's really like, you know, I think younger fans or, I don't know, maybe people who haven't quite grown into their fandom yet, when they see an adaptation, they want the checklist. And that's what they're there for. Like, Lord of the Rings, people sat there with their checklists.
Yeah, I bitch incessantly if there's something skipped over.
Yeah. But I think people like you, especially since you're a creative person anyway, like, you approach these with the right attitude, which is, I don't want to just see, I don't just want an exact replica. I want a new creative, amazing thing to come out of this.
Yeah.
You know? So that leads me to ask, like, did you see the recent Astro Boy? And if so, what did you think of it?
I avoided that.
Okay.
Okay, fair enough.
Smart.
In fact, I can tell you a little mini story about that. I think the first promotion at Anime Expo was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just walking around the big room and saw the booth with the Astro Boy statue in the tube, you know, in suspended animation, like he's about to wake up. So I thought, Astro Boy movie, interesting. And I went up to the guy at the booth and I said, so you're involved in the making of this movie? And he said, yes. And I said, is it going to be hand-drawn cell animation or is it CG? And he said, CG. And I said, sorry, you just lost me.
That's all it took.
I walked away and never looked back.
Really?
What's wrong with CG?
There's nothing wrong with CG when it's done right, but...
Well, you knew this wouldn't be.
Well, Astro Boy is... he's a character who was created on paper, always looked best on paper. I mean, or better, the better way to say that was he's always come through most warmly and most humanly as, shit, I gotta start.
Simple line art. Well, I kind of get where you're going with this. It's like seeing the new, well, not that new anymore, but those done in the mid-2000s MetLife commercials with Snoopy, and suddenly Snoopy has like 5,000 shades of gray all over his nose indicating shading, and just like, what is that?
Or like listening to the White Album on LP versus versus an MP3.
Yeah, so, to me, a CG Astro Boy is completely antithetical to the qualities of the original Astro Boy.
Well, that wasn't the problem with the film. The problem was the script. Do you think that there's potential in any of these stories? The sprawling sort of mecha action titles. Do you think there's potential for adaptations of those in the West? Do you think there's...
or at least a reboot?
Yeah, a reboot.
Again, it's going to have to be done by the right people, but I think the talent pool is there. There are numerous ways the Iron Man movies could have failed, but they flew right past them, did really well, seemed to satisfy everyone.
No, second one. It was okay.
It wasn't that bad.
It wasn't bad, it's just, it was a movie.
The newest Star Trek movie was, I thought, a great experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun to watch. I know a lot of the older fans of the original just complained bitterly through the entire thing, but... to me, it
they were drowned out by the like $300 million it made at the box office.
Well, not only that, like if you didn't like that movie, you just don't like fun. You weren't there to have fun. You were there to have your checklist.
I don't like fun, and I even like that movie.
Right.
That and the newest Battlestar Galactica, I think, shared the common feature, which is the people making them knew exactly what to grab from the older concept and bring forward and evolve into the newer concept and make it entertaining to watch again.
Nerdy tangent, how did you feel about the end of Battlestar Galactica?
I was very happy with it.
Really?
Yeah.
You're the only person, you're the only fan who whenever I ask that question, I always go, well...
Well, I had to come to that opinion, though.
Oh, okay.
Because right after I watched it, I thought, but what the hell was Starbuck?
Yeah, yeah.
And since I've gotten some distance from it, I realized if they explained what Starbuck was, then I wouldn't still be wondering about it and thinking about it and plugging my own imagination into it.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. I appreciate being allowed to still participate in the story after it was told by plugging in my own thinking.
Right, right. That's important.
I think that's also why a lot of the more unusual anime films of the 80s still hung on after a long time, because the ones that had ambiguous endings allow you to continue participating in the story when it's over. Utena was probably a good example of that. It made sense to maybe a handful of people, but the rest of us are all still wondering, why the hell did she turn into a car?
And that was the movie. The TV series had never had a real ending.
Yeah. But kind the of. Fact that we can still sit here and think about that and wonder about it and make up our own theory keeps it alive. And I think that's one of the best things entertainment can accomplish.
I think Utena turns into a car just because Ikuhara was like, can I get away with this? Can I really be this blunt with my allegories? well, that's about an hour. Do we want to wrap up here?
Yeah, why don't we?
Okay,
I like that note to end on.
Well, before we wrap completely, I'm curious. You are obviously a fan of refined taste. Is there anything recent that you would recommend to anime fans in terms of anime or just animation in general?
Gurren Lagann.
Gurren Lagann. Okay.
Gurren Lagann. Right.
No need to tell our audience about Gurren Lagann.
Yeah, they know about it. But did you see the film, and what did you think of the film?
I haven't seen the film yet.
Okay.
I just recently absorbed the series, and I've got kind of a bad habit in that I buy these things and then put them on a shelf, and then months or years will go by before I actually watch them.
Yeah. Part of being a working otaku.
Yeah, yeah. In this case, I bought the first version that Bandai put out, which was the sub-only. And finally got around to seeing it earlier this year and just enjoyed the hell out of it. Every minute of it.
It's a lot of fun.
And for me, it had a direct link back to some of the anime I grew up with, because I don't know how well this is known, but the inspiration for that show was an animator from the 70s and 80s named Yoshinori Kaneda.
Mm-hmm.
You can see his work in many of the Miyazaki films. He's also done projects on his own. One was not very well received. It was an OAV called Birth.
Oh
yeah, that had amazing animation, but was just kind of not cohesive in any way whatsoever.
Right. But he was the creative director behind that. He was the animation director. And so of all the projects he's worked on, I think that's the one that grabbed his style the most. You can also see him in the Galaxy Express movies. When they get to the big planet exploding sequences in each one, he takes over from there and just kicks ass with the animation. And so Yoshinori Kanata was a superstar. He's dead now. He died last year. But he inspired the director of Gurren Lagann to say, I want to make this series exactly the way Kanada would have made it. And so if you go into it with that mindset, you can see his influence from start to finish. It's a lot of fun. You know, all those extreme angles and poses, those right. are pure Kanada.
I actually still recommend Birth to people just because it's the only example I can think of in anime where it just never stops moving.
Yeah.
It is relentless. Anime is known for its breaths and its, frankly, sometimes laziness. But there is, like, moving camera throughout almost the entire thing.
Right.
Level animation.
And he really pioneered that technique, Kaneda did. Back in the 70s, he did a lot of the opening titles for the Super Robot shows.
Mm.
And his sort of mental breakthrough with all this stuff was, you know, we're artists drawing scenes for television. We can use all the tools of art to make this as impactful and as an impressive as we want it to be. The only limit is what we imagine. And so he approached it from that viewpoint instead of this is everything we do is a downstream function of the script and we just hew to the script. But he did all sorts of interesting things like stretch perspective and throw lighting effects on things. You know, whenever you see a camera lens flare come into a scene, that was his invention. And he also did a lot of things freehand. And the way you, in animation, you make that work for you is that you just keep a scene moving so that every frame moves from the next frame. Then you don't have to do a lot of backtracing. And it allows you to work faster as long as you have the confidence to do it. And so that's why Birth, as you say, never seems to stop moving. Because if it stopped moving, then it would take longer to draw, ironically. So he would keep it moving by making every frame different and as full of action and momentum as possible.
But the photography guys hated him.
Well, he created a lot more cells to be filled. That was for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. That was great, and we really appreciate your hospitality and chatting with us today. That was great. Thank you.
Happy to do it.
All right, guys, that's our show. I want to thank Tim so much for chatting with us. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. And as always, we will see you next week. All right, you guys.